Welcome to the Lineweave Podcast, once again taking to the airwaves. This is a show about how to save the tech industry through open source, open standards, and worker ownership. We're your hosts, John, and we have Blaine.
Hello.
Hello, Blaine. Mubs.
Hello, everyone.
And a special guest who we'll get to in a minute. Eric can't join us today. He's busy doing actual work. So the four of us own Limeleaf, a member-owned tech co-op specializing in Rust and Go software product development. Just a reminder that we've been working hard on apply.coop, our online job board for values-driven workplaces, wrapping up our beta testing period next week, and we'll go into full production. If you're interested in helping us build a platform that connects good people with great jobs, visit apply.coop and sign up. Job postings are free for podcast listeners. Just use promo code SOLIDARITY during checkout. So on to our main topic. Today, we're going to talk about paradigms. Paradigms in tech and software, but also, and probably more interestingly, in psychology. Yes, paradigm shifts will probably come up, like a lot of technical terms that have become cliches. That one doesn't mean what I thought it meant, certainly, as I was reading up about it. It doesn't just mean a big change, but we'll get into that in due course. So I want to welcome today's guest. Lori Smith has worked in human services for 20 years. She has an undergraduate degree in psychology and a master's degree in applied behavioral analysis and autism. These days, she provides quality assurance and investigatory support to people with developmental disabilities. Welcome, Lori.
Thank you guys for having me.
You're very welcome. All right. So what, first, just to, you know, begin at the beginning, what is a paradigm for those who think they know but maybe don't?
So there's an interesting analogy that I came across, the difference between a paradigm and perspective. So a lot of times those terms are used interchangeably, and it grinds my gears, if you will. but basically a good analogy for the difference between the two. A paradigm is when a puzzle is complete and you can see the full picture. Perspective is like the puzzle pieces that make up the puzzle. So when we're talking about paradigm, we're talking about a framework that folks in a specific field of study use to approach that subject. So it's basically how that world or that industry is studied. A lot of times it's used interchangeably with, like, you know, fashion trends and things like that. And that's more perspective. That's more, you know, likes and dislikes and things like that. Paradigms are more research-based, and sort of the resources that folks who provide that research use at the time. So okay. Hopefully that made sense.
Yeah. No, I you people are probably too young to remember this, but I remember in the 90s when paradigm shift became like this really fashionable thing that a lot of people we're talking about. And so this fellow named Thomas Kuhn was a sociologist, or so he was a scientist and researcher, and he coined this term in a book about the history of science. So I think everybody kind of has their own understanding of what he meant by that, but how did you interpret what paradigm shifts are, and maybe some examples if you have any?
Yeah. Oh, I got lots of examples. I got examples for days. So Thomas Kuhn was a philosopher of science. He had a PhD in physics, oddly enough. But he basically coined the term paradigm shift. He had a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which I've yet to read. It's in my Amazon cart, though. Shout out to Amazon. But basically his thought is that scientific progress happens through shifts in the frameworks that I was talking about. So you go from quote unquote normal science to revolutionary science. So the normal science is the routine work that's done. It's our current paradigm, if you will. And then revolutionary science is when anomalies pop up, which they always do. And that's what's fun. They're discovered. If they cause enough of a stir, it's moved to what he called crisis mode. In the scientific community. And the once those anomalies start creating that stir, the confidence in that current paradigm that researchers had starts to wear down, and then that new framework is developed that it kind of explains how those anomalies become adopted into life. So, examples, as far as psychology is concerned, if we're talking about old versus new paradigms, you know, shout out to my master's degree, but behaviorism is an old paradigm. It's, you know, it was considered to be, you know, that observable behavior is the only thing that should be studied. This is actually why I did not pursue my master's degree. I disagreed with that. So they sort of based everything on empirical stimulus response experiments. The anomaly, however, was when they couldn't explain internal mental functions, language acquisition, problem solving, memories, dreams, things like that. So the new paradigm, cognitive psychology, which I think most people have heard that, know what that is, cognitive behavioral therapy, things of that nature. So all of those anomalies like memories, language, attention, reasoning, sort of got transformed with experimental methods. This sort of ties into you folks. When we think of cognitive psychology, we also kind of can nod to computer science because of information processing models that computer science uses. So a lot of cognitive behavioral therapists use that model to explain things. Yeah.
I did not know that.
Interesting.
So is Freudianism a paradigm, or is that just a...
It is. Okay. Yeah, so that was psychoanalysis.
Okay.
Sigmund Freud was all about the unconscious conflicts from childhood, yep. Right? Everything was mom's fault, dad's fault. The anomalies for that were it's not duplicatable, right? You can't prove or disprove any of that. So that new model was then empirical scientific psychology that's testable and observable.
Yeah, it's kind of wild how he just sort of made it up. He's like, you know what? In your dream, there was a bear. And what that means, it's like, what?
Well, it means your mom
he was a brilliant guy, no doubt. Like, Freud changed the world, no doubt about it. But a little bit subjective. Like, well, I don't know. So software. I mean, Blaine, if you want to talk a little bit about some of the paradigms that we in the software business work with.
Sure. I mean, if we could sort of think about some of those shifts from, you know, going from like the original like vacuum tube computers to like the transistors, and how we understand and, you know, move bits around a machine, you know, in a local state. And then we, you know, sort of fast forward to sort of the internet age, you know, a lot of this, a lot of the information processing that we've been doing on local instances of computation and CPUs and things like that, you know, that can be, you know, sort of tied to the brain as far as like little synapses. Like you can sort of predict and plan like a few synapses together, but once you explode that into the size of a brain and you introduce the internet of these connected devices, like you have this very large, very indeterminate brain working, as even though a lot of this is built around deterministic, you know, electrical signals moving back and forth. When you start to, you know, increase the size of that exponentially and you introduce the amount of variables that are in the world, then you sort of like have this little bit of indeterminism. So we're sort of seeing these shifts, you know, when the internet age sort of happened, multi-core processors on machines have happened, going from one single CPU to, you know, multiple threads running at the same time, adding in the internet, mm-hmm. and now all of a sudden adding in, you know, this whole quote-unquote AI, you know, revolution. This is sort of where we are, where we are now. And that, but then that mostly focuses on, like, computation right now of, like, you know, core computer science. But we have these sort of paradigms, as programmers in our sort of slice of the world, you know, we initially started out with writing this very procedural, you know, stuff and programs in this the best English that we could possibly get. So do this, add these two numbers, take that result, add it to this number. That is very procedural. And we sort of saw that with like punch cards and then assembly languages, really low level stuff. But then as...
Or me in ninth grade writing BASIC.
Yes, yes. That's fun. Hey, I wrote that too. I'm not that old.
Yep.
I'm old enough to understand that. But then, as computers got more powerful and we, wanted to make our lives easier, we sort of layered on different paradigms to, produce the same assembly at the very end for the CPU to understand, but then we add in different languages. So we're talking about more procedural, high-level languages or interpreted languages, or things like object-oriented languages. So we're writing these programs that represent the physical world. So I might write a person, class, or object in my program, and then I attach properties to it, whether it's the name or the age, and then I attach behaviors to them, such as move left, move right, jump, that kind of thing. So you see a lot of the stuff in like the game world. You have these objects that represent physical things in the world, and then they're graphically represented in this digital space. So you see, like I said, a lot of that in gaming. A different paradigm of programming is functional. And you see that in a lot of the scientific world, where you have these very procedural, like, discrete input-output steps, and you chain these steps together to get whatever result you're after. Because what they did to help them in the mathematical world program was to take the mathematical notation that you see in all these math books, and how do we translate that into characters a computer can understand, so that it can write like a summation formula to sum over this complex equation and get the result. And so out came these programming languages, which are more functional based and logic based, to get that stuff. While we as Limeleaf necessarily don't do that in our world, because all of our systems are built on long-term running systems where we have this sort of global state that we're constantly manipulating. Like, people are signing into our system, they're doing things, they're changing their profiles, they're posting things. And so there's state that is kept and stored that they're interacting with. So that's not the same thing as like a sort of a functional process. So you sort of have these two different paradigms in like programming themselves.
Okay. Well, as usual on the podcast, I'm the one who's not afraid to sound dumb. And this is going to be a dumb question, but so the brain, first of all, so the fact that I'm of a certain age, let's say over 50, the fact that I have in my brain things that happened to me when I was 6 years old that are in there, how in the hell do they have any clue yet how that actually works? I mean, I know it's electrical impulses, but there's some kind of, and again, this gets into metaphors, like there's some kind of storage in my head where I can remember being 6 years old and standing in the cold at the bus stop. That's a picture in my mind. That's there, and it happened. Like, I know memory is subjective and everything, but how does that work? And then we'll get into how that's analogous to how computers work, but.
You're not nearly as dumb as you think you are. So you're welcome. So that's your hard drive. That's your long-term memory, right? It exists. It might not be as prevalent as your RAM, your short-term memory, right? But it is there. And that is why behaviorism sort of would be an older paradigm, because those memories that you have of being at the bus stop, it happens, but behaviorism would argue that that's the only reason you remember it is because there were different reinforcements in your life that kept that a prevalent part of you, your mind. Like, you were reinforced positively or negatively or through aversive conditioning. Remember that moment. But I think that, that's possible. That is why, but I think that are also hard drive and RAM, all that exists as well, so they can all sort of work together like a computer.
And it's connections of neurons, basically. is what makes that mm-hmm. possible.
Yes. So there's synapses, neurotransmitters. Okay. I mean, don't even get me started on that. But, you know, as far as your cognition, that's your software. You know, that's your cognitions are your thoughts. The software, you wouldn't be able to have a computer do anything without software, correct? Or a hard drive or RAM. All of it work. They work hand in hand. And, you know, let's say the first computer model probably wouldn't be as, you know, great as the current computer models. Mm-hmm. And that's because of like what has and hasn't worked over time and what, you know, now works well together.
Right. So that now gets a little bit into machine learning and as we'll talk about eventually AI. So the idea of a neural network, what the hell is a neural network? And, and is it a metaphor for how we understand the brain to work?
It's a little of both. So neural network, I think, is a really fun, snazzy way of saying that we have brains. So neurons are formed over the course of our lives. Neurotransmitters' jobs are to emit different chemicals in our brains, dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, oxytocin, all the things that make us do or don't do things. So they talk to each other. They have to. That's why a lot of times people, you know, have to take medication because they don't have, they had too much or not enough serotonin or their dopamine is, they're totally deprived of dopamine. So, the network sometimes goes down, believe it or not. So those, you know, medications that you might take or even just engaging in a 15-minute walk outside, you know, can really boost that network and get it from not working to working a little better.
So Blade in computer science or MUBS, the neural network that we now understand as being some part of AI stuff. What is that about?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I haven't studied neural networks in a while, so my understanding is might be out of date, but my understanding of neural networks is kind of very similar to what Justori said in terms of, yeah, it's basically the brain in that you get large amounts of inputs, and there's, with neural networks especially, you have to train the neural networks, which is kind of what we do as we learn things, right? Like as we get these inputs, mm-hmm. we kind of get either the positive or the sort of negative results as to whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. And then that helps us learn what the outcome is supposed to be. And so you kind of do the same mm-hmm. thing with neural networks and with AI. You say, given all of these inputs, this is the output that we're expecting at the end of it. And based on, you know, where those all lie and where those bonds form through the neural network, that kind of helps you in the future. If you come across a similar situation, what's the most likely outcome as well? And so they have tried to model computer neural networks to function the same way in the brain works. Obviously, it's not exactly the same because there's no chemicals and things inside of a computer system yet. I'm sure they're working on that at some point too. Right. But yeah, essentially it's, you've got this wide array of inputs and you've got hundreds and millions, if not billions of ways to kind of look for different inputs. But ultimately you want to get to a result state. So what's the value? What's the yes or no answer that you're looking for? And, but it's also trying to train it so that if you see something similar, you want to essentially get to the same output. And I guess that's the same, like we see the same thing. You know, we see something on the road. Does that mean we should accelerate in the car? Should that mean we should stop in the car? You know, things like that. We're trying to see the inputs that we have. What's the action that we should take? And I think computers are basically trying to do the same thing. That's essentially what ChatGPT does, right? There's these terabytes and more than terabytes of information that they've collected and analyzed, you know, from all over the world. And then you give it a question. It says, oh, I've seen a similar question to this. Like, what was the output of that? And it kind of tries to create a similar output based on that input. So that's, I mean, I think that's my understanding of it. But yeah, so that's, I'm sure there might be others though as well.
Yeah, no, you basically hit it right on the head. And that was the very beginnings of machine learning, right? When we first started this, the one things to sort of call up the difference, you know, when you were explaining the training session and how like the actual human brain works and trains, is we're still at the point where there's two distinct and discrete steps. Like there is a training phase, and then once training is done, that model is then deployed or put somewhere, and then it is then given inputs that it's never seen before. So when that is running, it's not learning anymore. It's fixed. It can sort of do predictions and stuff like that, but if it stays there for 10 years, hasn't learned anything. You need to retrain it. So there are two distinct steps that occurs. And training is usually done behind sort of closed doors on very, very, very powerful machines to sort of build the initial model of connections. So you may start the build of the model and have, you know, a million connections, but then after training, you have magnitude larger. Some of these large language models like ChatGPT and things like that, you constantly see the names being thrown out like, oh, new model released, you know, Claude, whatever. They're on the sizes of like 2 billion connections now. So that's how large these things are. And it takes a lot of computational power, a lot of electricity, a lot of hydropower, like all of that stuff to actually perform all of this training to get this fixed model state. And then that file system gets deployed, and then you go talk to it. Prior, you know, the initial models were the best examples that you saw out there were like character recognition for like handwriting, right? So you do character recognition, so you're feeding it these images of, you know, millions of people's versions of a handwritten letter A, right? And then out the other side, you do a guesstimation level of like a 0 to 1, like what's the percentage that you think that this is an A, and then you just sort of rank them. And then at the end, it says, okay, now I can take somebody's other written letter of the A and say, here, what letter is this? Do you think it's an A? And like its confidence level, that's the actual term for it, is what's the confidence level that you think this is an A? And it might output something like 0.81. So it's 81%, you know, accurate that it thinks it's an A. And so we've gone from that step all the way to where we are today with large language models, because now it's not just standard models of character recognition or computer vision, where all of these models originally were very discrete on their very specific task. Now, large language models are, let's just feed it the internet. Let's fuck around and find out when we feed it the internet. And we're finding out.
It's not just, right, it's not just quote-unquote language. It's not just text. It's images, videos. Like, they're just churning everything into these things to, quote-unquote, train them. And is it true that, so, you know, from what I've read and heard, like, they're like, well, we don't really understand how they work. They're doing this thing. And then you can ask it a question, but we don't really understand how the computer, how it's doing this.
Well, let me ask you this by asking Laura this question. Laura, do you understand how the brain works?
No, yeah. And anybody that says they do is lying. Including the world's leading neurologists and surgeons.
We have an idea.
Their confidence level.
We kind of have an idea, but we're not fully sure. And it's the same with this. We kind of think, and that's why we wrote the software to do these things. But are we 100% sure? Once the model started to learn and train itself, or it's been trained, it's like you know what you told it how to learn, but you don't know what it actually learned.
100%, which is why it's impossible to, one, stay with one paradigm, mm-hmm. right? And two, argue that anything that we learn is just a result of external factors. Mm. ChatGPT, like you were talking about with, you know, the different, you know, models and confidence levels and things of that nature. How can you account for the fact that one model of ChatGPT, like, why did it have to be updated? Oh, that's because it encountered anomalies. Mm. Its confidence level went down. And now we need a new model because this one's too stupid. Mm.
you know, or just out of date. Like, I remember when ChatGPT first started blowing up, you'd sort of ask it something, it'd be like, well, I only, you know, it was like 2023, let's say. I was like, well, my date only goes to like September 2021. It's like this thing's 2 years out of date. Like, I mean, obviously they're closing that window because now they're throwing billions of dollars at just, you know, as many GPUs as they can crank out in a factory. But
I think to me, the interesting thing is like we do these things, we build these things, we put them out there. We don't really know what, like, even with your Plane was talking about the internet and how, you know, now it's everywhere. When we built the internet, we didn't really know how it was going to be used, right? Like, at the beginning, it was an educational thing, and the military was using it for some stuff, mostly for, like, disaster recovery protocol-wise. Like, you could take off one node, but the system would still work, and yeah, that's kind of what
nuclear fallout.
Yeah, you know, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why Al Gore invented it.
Yeah, exactly. But ultimately, we didn't. I mean, I don't think even Al Gore knew what the internet was going to become. And I think it's kind of the similar with these large language models and things. We kind of think we know what we want to do with them. We kind of think why did we build these things? But once they go out there in the world, people start doing some weird and crazy shit with them. And you're never quite sure what the outcome will be, because you don't actually, again, I guess it comes back to the human, in that we don't know what people are going to imagine, what they can do with these things as well.
Right. And the people that are involved, and the populations of people that are involved with the human brain, as opposed to like the ChatGPT brain, quote unquote, right? The people that are trying to understand, the neurologists, the psychologists, all of that stuff, are trained, vetted, like certifications out the wazoo, clinical trials, human trials, all this stuff. There's checks and balances along the way before any of these paradigms sort of make it out to the world, right? The problem here is ChatGPT just has some fucking billionaire behind it, so it's like, fucking deploy it. Like, let's see what happens. Like, whatever.
It's cool, man.
Right?
Check it out.
There's so that. I think, you know, nobody really is. Not a lot of folks are like really against like trying to understand and build these models. It's the social impact and the recklessness that's going along with it, right? Aside from like the, you know, like I said, the hydroelectric power and the electric power required at this point to train it is one thing, like the impact on the climate and the planet, that's one thing. But then just to be a little bit more, you know, willy-nilly about launching this stuff into the world and finding out the results.
Well, even they themselves are like, yeah, it could probably destroy the world, but
yeah,
you know, we'll just put it out there.
Yeah, actually, that's a very good topic.
And you guys better give us more money to make sure it doesn't destroy the world. It's this weird circular logic thing that is so bizarre to me.
If you actually want to watch this, like Laurie and I actually watched this movie recently called Mountainhead. It's on HBO. Go watch that. It's got Steve Carell and a few other guys. It's basically four billionaires staying at like playing poker and eating food in this guy's house, and they're just like, and it's just recorded the four of them. They're all on their phones, just basically watching the world fall apart because one of the guys released an AI model, and the fake news just like ripped through the entire world, and like people are dying. Like, it's just crazy, and they're just all kind of goofing off about it.
It was triggering.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're talking about paradigm shifts, and I think, yeah, it is. It's kind of it's going back to the Industrial Revolution. Like, you know, we used to plow fields with horses, and you know, having them pull the hays around and things like that. Like, and now suddenly we got machines that could do these things in much faster, much more efficient ways. And now we're getting to that. Yeah, this is going to be the information revolution. It's not even the information revolution. This is really the intelligence revolution, in that what we thought only humans could do, now machines can do. And I think, and when I think back to computers, and yeah, I'm going to kind of age myself as well, but, you know, we used to think about computers as like a brute force tool. In terms of like when you cracked passwords and things, you just try every combination. When IBM was trying to train computers to beat chess masters, it was just yeah, can you just train it with every possible move that a person could make? And what was the outcome? And then you find the right path out of that. It was brute force. I think we're coming to a revolution. We're coming to a paradigm shift where it's like, well, computers don't have to do, they don't have to be that sledgehammer anymore. They can be the artist who's sculpting, you know, who's taking a stone and making a statue out of it now. It doesn't have to be this brute force thing. And it is. We don't know how that changes society. Like, we didn't know how the Industrial Revolution is going to change the world. And I don't think we have any clue yet how this shift is going to change society as a whole.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that most paradigm shifts, paradigms in general, like when you were, you know, saying the revolution, that revolutionary science that Thomas Kuhn was talking about, you know, that is when that paradigm shift happens. And we don't grow as a society. Our machines don't grow. Things don't grow unless there is that revolution. There are those anomalies. Right. And you know, arguably exciting part about it is that we don't know what's going to happen. And if there was every human on the planet was well-intentioned and genuinely wanted to make a difference in the world and, mm-hmm. and wanted these paradigm shifts to benefit, you know, as many people as it can, then, you know, it's going to be fully exciting, right? But then, like, you know, that there's people in the world that, like you said, they're like, yeah, fuck it, deploy it anyway, you know?
Well, and the outcome that they want is, and this is where Blaine and Mubs listen to me rant about this all the time. What these guys want is cheap. They want everything to be cheaper. And the way you do that is to speed everything up. And eventually you end up with no humans. Like, all these billionaires want to be trillionaires. And the way to get there is to have as few humans doing knowledge work as possible. And that's, they genuinely yeah. believe that, like, all right, finally, we can finally get rid of all these programmers and QA people, all these people that we have to pay money. I want all that money. You know, that's kind of, I'm convinced that's the way they're thinking about it. They're not, I don't think that they have very enlightened motives. I think it's all just more accumulation. That's,
I would agree with that. And I think a wild thing about that is that the billion trillionaires wouldn't have gotten to where they are without humans. And, you know, you could say,
well, yeah, without humans paying taxes, that a lot of those guys made a lot of their wealth from us.
You know? Unfortunately, I think it's a very short-term view, though, right? Like, because I think if you look back over the last 50 years, I mean, like, obviously what's driven their wealth has been an increase in consumption. The more we consume, the more we need to buy, the more we need to buy, the more we need to make, the more money that people make. If this era of revolution actually takes hold, is consumption actually going to increase? Like, are people going to have the money to spend to fund all of that stuff? I don't think it would, right? Like, it eventually gets to the point where if people aren't working, if people aren't consuming, then all of a sudden industry breaks down. You can be as productive as you want as a software company or as a company making things. Nobody's buying stuff anymore. It doesn't matter. And so that's why I think you need to raise all boats, right? Like, you can't just say, I want that incoming sort of inequality that's happening is actually long-term. It's going to hurt things versus if you try and raise everybody a little bit, I think, you know, that's going to ultimately advance society much more, but we'll see. I mean, I don't know if we'll be around when all of this happens, but I certainly hope AI can help keep me alive a lot longer.
Right. And that's the goal of this, right? Because if the North Star of this revolution is to imitate the human brain, right? That's where everybody wants to go. And right now we have the human brain. We all have one. And we use that brain to manipulate our meat bags, to do work, to make money, to feed ourselves and sustain ourselves and all of that stuff. Like, that is the cycle of our existence at its core, right? It is completely unsustainable right now for some of these models. It's like OpenAI right now, I don't think has made any money.
No.
Not even close.
Hell no.
They're like, they're borrowing and borrowing, investing. They haven't made any money. They haven't made a dime. And they're paying everybody on their salaries based on investor income. So the fact that, like, what they're building, their brain that this machine is building, is not generating enough monetary value to then pay for the resources it needs to keep growing. We as an individual human can do that. We have our own brains and we can do that. We all can go to our jobs and do that. This thing can't. And I think that's where it's going to start to break down. And that's where they need to make, like, the revolution.
Even now, when people talk about using Claude and these things to, like, write their software for them, they don't really tell you, one, the software's not that good because it's just not that good. But also, when you look at actually how much it costs to, like, generate that software, they're doing it fairly cheaply right now because, as you said, OpenAI is basically giving the software away for free because it's not that good. And if you actually, you know, had high-quality software to actually generate the high-quality software, the cost of, like, the AI to train the AI and to have it do the work is actually not going to be that far off from just hiring a human to do it instead. So that's why I still think we've got a long way to go. People talk about AGI and things like that. I still think we've got a long way to go. I think one of the things that you said earlier, Brian, was that, you know, these models right now, or these systems that we have in terms of AI, you know, they have a couple of billion effectively neurons in them. That's still, what is that, like 2% of what the human brain has? And so I think there's still a lot hardware wise that we have to improve before we can get even close to what this human brain can do. The whole quantum computing thing, which is probably going to be the next shift in terms of hardware, at least, you know, as far as I've ever known, computers were 0 and 1. There wasn't anything else. With quantum, you can have multiple states. So we'll see what that means exactly.
We'll do an episode on that eventually. Because
there's only so far you can push the boundaries of a 0 and 1 based electrical system, right?
Yep.
Like, there's only so far you can go, especially if you keep that system within the confines of the electrical grid and the cost to generate that power, right? I know it's like pulling like a ChatGPT question, how to write an email, down to the fact that it literally takes like whatever kilowatts on the electrical grid to generate what that just happened. That's a long connection string. But that's the system. That's, you got to play within those boundaries. You know, quantum is definitely different. But yeah, right now it's just a very expensive endeavor for that stuff to happen.
Well, the strategy that seems to be emerging now is they're like, well, we want the government to give us a lot of money to throw at this, not to employ humans, but to just keep cranking more kilowatts out of nuclear power plants. Like, that seems to be what they're trying to do with the current administration in America, is like, well, you know, the government gives us $500 trillion to
build this, which I'm not against, because right. We did that with nuclear energy, we did that with the internet. Like, I'm not opposed to the government being involved in that and us thinking about what the implications of these advances are. The bit that worries me is, like, give us all our money, but don't regulate us and don't put any control over what we can do. Like, that worries me a little bit.
And the output of the investment is profit,
right,
to investors. It's not profit to the human race. It's not raising the standard of living for people. That's it.
Yeah.
Like, that's all they want, is to have the output of this be more profits. It's
the same with the,
it's a very weird thing.
Vaccines and things, right? Like, the government funds the research in vaccines because we want to save people's lives. But at the end of the day, the government doesn't actually own any part of the vaccine either, which, again, doesn't really make any sense to me. If you've invested all this amount of money to help save the people, you should also not have to pay thousands of dollars per shot or per pill or whatever it is as well.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of profit, you know, I work for a not-for-profit, and you know, I have the folks that I support, you know, some of them are like, are you really not for profit? And I, you know, yeah, technically we're an NPO, but I mean, at the end of the day, yeah, we're looking for funding. Yeah. We're grant funded, you know? And there are certain things that we do to be grant funded, every NPO, not just where I work. And, you know, that's, there's a fine line between, yeah, we're seeking profit to care for people, and in order to care for people, we need a lot of money to build houses and have fleets of vans and, you know, pay the people that, you know, essentially live with them. But at what like point is it okay, but also we want to be the biggest and best NPO in the entire region. So we want even more money and we want this. And then, okay, but is that benefiting the people we support or is that just benefiting the C-suite? You know, and I can say, luckily for my organization, and I'm not just saying this because I'm being recorded, that's not the case, but there are plenty of NPOs that they're like, oh yeah, we're totally NPO. We're, you know, altruistic. And,
and the CEO makes $2 million a year.
Yeah. And I'm happy to say that my CEO does not.
I think that's, yeah. I mean, sorry, I was just going to just to wrap that up a little bit. I was just going to say that it's the same in terms of like why we set up as a co-op, right? Like the point, we need to make money. We need to earn a living. We need to pay the bills. But at what point is the motivation purely about money, purely about profit? Versus, well, we live in this world. We need to contribute back into this world. We need to improve the world in any way that we can. And yes, making a profit is a part of that. Like the way that we improve the world is to make a profit so that we can do the things that we want to do. But that shouldn't be the only goal of an organization. And when you look at most Fortune 500 companies, the way that the system is structured around all of those is their one purpose, their sole primary purpose is to make as much money as they can. And that to me is just completely the wrong way around.
Agreed. So, Laurie, so we have behaviorism, we have cognitive behavioral. So are there any emerging paradigms that we should be like looking for? I mean, obviously things are always changing and shifting, but does anybody have any kind of clue what the next paradigm in psychology is or behavioral science or whatever?
So I think, I mean, everybody probably has different viewpoints on that. There, you know, definitely current paradigm being cognitive psychology, I would say. More emerging paradigm would be probably positive psychology, which is based in cognitive behavioral therapy. But it's a scientific framework that studies well-being and happiness. So it kind of sounds like, oh, cupcakes and rainbows, cool, which it kind of is. And I love cupcakes and rainbows. But the older paradigm version of that was humanistic psychology, which was about personal growth, subjective experiences, things like that. But it was more philosophical. And I'm a huge fan of philosophy. But it can't really, it can't be described as empirical, I guess, because philosophy is very subjective. You know, someone can interpret, you know, some awesome philosophical quote that I can't think of right now, and then that's the interpretation, and somebody else can interpret it entirely differently, and the person who said it will tell you, well, that's not what I meant. So it's all very subjective. So you can't really say, oh, well, it's evidence-based. And I think that there's definitely a place for it, you know, because it brings discussion, it brings conversation, which all of that builds to research and builds to, you know, growth. But I think that, you know, with positive psychology, it's based more on studying that well-being and happiness. What organizational psychology, for instance, like how do we retain employees? How do we make sure that the people that work here are happy? Because if they're happy, they're going to keep working here. How do we make sure that work-life balance is intact? You know, with COVID and everybody working from home, a lot of organizations sort of had to have people work from home. The more, in my humble opinion, developed organizations realized, oh wow, our employees are actually really happy. The productivity is, it's pretty much the same. So why don't we just put that all together and come up with a hybrid schedule, come up with a fully remote schedule, and I think that organizations are still looking at that and seeing like, oh, you know, this actually is working. And then that's kind of why this new paradigm is sort of gaining traction, if you will, because of, you know, the fact that that's how the world is literally working right now.
Yeah, and it would be super interesting to see, like, to sort of leverage how the computer science side of those models could help facilitate that understanding. You know, during the training phases, you can train a model to have like certain experiences, and then maybe you play it through certain work-life balance scenarios and things like that, and see the kind of like shifts based on the general population of an organization or a social group or a community, to see like how the outputs of those trained people, quote unquote, brains, models, whatever, sort of like change the result of everything. So I can see like there is a very useful, you know, scientific research-based application to all of this machine learning, AI, LLM stuff that can help research the psychology side of and human behavior side of those industries, if those are sort of like fixed in that spot. And I don't think anybody on this call would argue against like those tools being available to help further that kind of research in a more altruistic, nonprofit based way, to sort of like, this is what we want. This is what the computer scientists probably wanted from the beginning when they first started about, you know, machine learning was first mentioned in the 1950s. Like, this is not a new thing. Like, this is an inevitability at this point.
Yeah, there have been multiple quote unquote AI, like in the 60s, you know, that AI, oh, this is it. Artificial intelligence is finally here. I mean, it's happened 3 or 4 times now. But I was just going to say, there's a similar thing going on in economics right now, trying to shift that paradigm from one of output productivity, you know, what measuring everything is like, well, as long as your GNP is growing at a certain percentage, or then everything's cool. It's like, well, that ignores pretty much every other factor of human existence. So there's this shift.
Cost of living.
Yeah. So like that, there's a lot of economists who are arguing for like, well, what we really need is some kind of measurement of how happy people are, or how well their basic needs are being met. And let's start measuring success in terms of that, instead of just, you know, we had 2% growth, we had 3% growth, we've, you know, it doesn't even begin to tell the whole story of what's going on. But so that would be another example of I think a paradigm shift that is, at least, if it's not underway, there are at least people trying to get it moving.
Yeah. But, and what's part of the frustrating part is like all of this computational power that's used to train the models that we're interacting with, just to make fake gorilla videos, like camping in the woods. Like,
he's obsessed with
this. Imagine if we had all that computational power to run the scenarios for behaviorism, for economics, for all of this stuff. Like, let's use that and pay for that result instead. You know, pick your favorite disaster movie. Oh, we got to run the climate model because we don't know which way the hurricane's going to hit and kill everybody. So let's send all this data up to Alaska because they got the big computing grid. Like, that's like, let's use the resources for that stuff.
I think that's the other interesting thing about AI specifically. Not really talking about paradigm shifts much anymore, but the whole thing with AI is we're trying to replicate, I think, well, a certain part of the human brain that we kind of think we understand, which is like the whole neural network inputs and outputs kind of thing. But to get to AGI, you know, the systems have to start learning for themselves. But even then, they need inputs to learn, just like we do, right? Like, as we're young, as we're kids, as we're growing, we get all these inputs from the world. And then we try and learn, and then there's something else that's happening in our brain that allows us to make a leap outside of what we've already learned, have an idea, have a thought of something that might be true, even though all our inputs have told us it's completely wrong, which is what we're talking about in terms of like a revolution of these things. You know, somebody, you know, even with things like gravity, and is the Earth the center of the universe, or is Earth just floating around the sun, which is a part of, you know, galaxies? if you just looked at your inputs, you wouldn't have ever made that leap. But somebody made that leap just based on something that's happening inside of the human brain. And I don't think we've quite figured out what makes the brain do that. And so in terms of like paradigm shifts and stuff, until we get to that point, I think there will always be a gap in between in terms of how smart AI can be, because it can only be as smart as the input that we feed it, and it will always be as a level behind as that input is in terms of like the new facts that we've seen or the new output that there is that we can use to kind of train it. When we get to the point where software can actually make these leaps and actually try and see what see the future in terms of what could be possible, that's going to be the scary bit. But also then, you know, how much computational power do you need to do those things? And do we have a power source that's like flexible and durable and abundant enough to make that possible? I think that's the other thing that in terms of computing, at least, there's always been this, hardware needs to get better so the software can get better. Hardware needs to get better so the software can get better. And over the last, we've had Moore's law for a while in terms of how much better CPUs can get, you know, sort of every 18 months or whatever. But I don't think we've really thought about what that looks like in like an AI kind of powered world. And I think that's the other thing that I think people, that's why I think AGI is a long way away, is not just from, you know, we just can't write the software, but the hardware is so far behind that, and power I think is that far behind as well. The amount of power we need, the storage of kind of electricity and things like that, that's one of the reasons I think electric cars aren't as prevalent as they should be. Not because we can't make really, really good cars, it's, well, how do you power them? And I'm not going to stop every hour at the next rest area so I can plug it in. So I think there's a lot of advancements in hardware that need to happen so that the software can improve kind of as well. And that does have a lot to do with our understanding of the human brain works. And we tried to model hardware now in that same way. So it's gonna be interesting to see what the hardware side of things kind of looks like as well.
All right. Well, so that's it for this month's episode. We hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. I feel like I learned a lot. See the show notes for links to stuff we mentioned in this episode. If you'd like to get in touch, we're available on Mastodon, Open Collective, Blue Sky, LinkedIn. All those links and more are available on our website at limeleaf.coop. That's limeleaf.coop. And also check out apply.coop. It's coming along and it's getting pretty amazing. We've made a lot of progress in a very short amount of time. So if you would like to throw us a few shekels, you can do so on Open Collective. Just go to opencollective.com/LimeLeaf. LimeLeaf is a worker-owned cooperative. If you're interested in starting your own tech co-op, we encourage everybody to do so, particularly if you've been laid off from a big tech company and feeling down and your prospects are not looking good, just do it. Start a co-op. Get some people together. You can do it. You can make enough money to live on. You're not going to get rich or become a billionaire, but you'll have a much better standard of living. But anyway, if you want to do that, go to start.coop, start.coop. That's a great place to learn all about worker co-ops, what they do, how you can start one. They have lots of tools there and information about doing just that. So that's it. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you again next month.
Thank you.
Bye.